Hi, welcome to Measure to Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument, maybe it's ancient or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, who built it, how it was built, when it was built, and why it was built.
That's right. I'm very excited about today's topic. I think it's super underrated and most people don't think twice about it.
I mean, unless it goes wrong.
That's right. The only time people think about it is when it goes wrong.
Like most things in life.
It's the sewer system.
Yes. So this is a real glamorous, exciting, sexy episode that we're going to get into.
Yeah. We're going to specifically talk about the London Interceptor sewers. Or as I like to call this episode, the shit flows downhill episode.
Yeah. So a little bit of background on this episode. Vivian has been researching this episode for quite a while now. And the number of times that she's like come over to me and she had like, you know, a book or her iPad or something with me. And she's just like, oh my God, John, I cannot wait for you to hear how crazy this episode is. So I'm personally pretty excited about this. You've built it up a lot.
I know. Yeah. I find it super interesting. I have loved the London Interceptor sewers for too long, and it doesn't totally make sense, but I'm going to get into why. There's a lot of good stories here. There's a lot of good innovation, and there's just a great hero and a great villain that might make it in as a bonus episode. We're going to see how the hero episode goes first.
Right. Okay. So good. Let's get into this glamorous, exciting episode.
Yeah. All right. So the setting is London, England in the Victorian era.
Okay.
We're in the 1850s.
Cool.
The London Interceptor sewers at this time was basically a system of six major sewers, roughly 160 kilometers long. The Interceptor sewers basically took all of the waste from London that used to just drain directly into the Thames and funneled it kind of outside of London into the Thames.
Right.
And there's a good reason why the people didn't want their waste flowing directly into the river that was right where they were living.
Yeah. Okay. So that all makes perfect sense. So basically what this interceptor sewer was doing was it was just taking all of the waste downstream of London.
Correct. Yeah. And it makes sense to you why they would want to do that. But remember, this is Victorian era. So this was kind of right before they understood how diseases were formed.
Right.
They still thought like a bad smell led to disease. So this was called the miasma theory. And it was just the idea that if something smelled bad, it was going to make you sick just by inhaling it.
Okay. And again, I mean, there's a logic to that, right? Like a lot of times things that do smell bad will give you a disease.
Yeah. But not from smelling it.
Right.
Right.
From being around it.
Well, okay. So I'll get into that.
Okay. And quick geography question. So downstream of London, do we know where that, like, are they basically just sending all of their poop to Scotland?
Oh, no, they didn't go that far downstream. You know how in Toronto here, we call Toronto the city and then GTA, the greater Toronto area.
Yeah.
They didn't even get outside of like the GLA at the time.
Right. Okay.
So they're still within the metropolitan area of London. Just kind of outside of the rich neighborhood of London at the time, or the more populated part of London at the time.
Okay. So that makes sense. And I mean, I'm starting from scratch here. I don't even know which direction the Thames flows in.
So this is going east.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So it's flowing east-west. It's going kind of towards the ocean.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. A little bit of stats here. I think the stats aren't super interesting, but a little bit of stats. There were three of the sewers were north of the Thames. Three were south of the Thames. They both outfall east of London. There was one outfall in the north, one outfall in the south. both include a pumping station that actually pumps all the sewage back up to sea level,
right,
so that it could flow out. Because by the time you have these long sewers that are draining downhill from what was already pretty low-lying land,
yeah,
along the Thames, then it was getting very far below sea level.
Right.
So there were also two major pumping stations.
Okay.
It also included the Thames Embankment, which is what you walk along now when you're walking in London along the Thames. It's okay. That entire kind of like walled up area with the nice, you know, boulevard.
Right.
And the pathway and the highway as well.
And so that was built to hide the sewers? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
It's a nice area. I like it.
Yeah. It took 670,000 cubic meters of concrete and 318 million bricks to build.
Okay.
So most of the sewers were actually made out of bricks.
Yeah.
So I try to figure out how to wrap my mind around how many bricks this was. It's roughly a 12th of the Wall of China. Does that help?
1/12. Okay.
So if you built 12 of these kind of sewers, you would get the Wall of China.
Right. And is this the Wall of China or a Wall of China?
The Wall of China.
The great one.
Yeah.
Okay.
The great one.
Yes.
Not the pretty good one.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a lot of bricks.
It was a lot of bricks, but not as many bricks as the Great Wall of China.
Well, I mean, considering that it was built pretty quickly compared to the Wall of China and within a pretty centralized geography, that it actually drove up the cost of both bricks and bricklayers at the time.
That's like, pretty impressive.
Pretty significantly to the point where their initial cost estimate was blown out of the water because of the price of bricks.
Right. Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. And it's funny because it is a mistake that we keep making to this day when we have these really major projects that calls for some specialized material or some specialized trade. And a lot of it, we tend to forget that that demand is just going to drive up the price. So that's not even unusual.
Right. It's funny, though.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to start with the history. The history is super interesting, super gross.
Okay. Yeah. Hit me with it. I love this. I love gross stuff.
Okay. So Victorian England, 1830s roughly, they invented the water closet.
Okay.
So WCs, these are your toilets, but they hadn't figured out indoor plumbing yet. So I don't know how they figured out toilets before they really figured out plumbing. But basically, the toilets drained into these cesspools in the basement of each building.
Right.
If you were lucky, they would drain into some of the lost rivers of London, which were these ancient streams that used to run along London. But the Romans kind of used the sewers anyway. So they bricked over these natural streams and they would throw their waste in there. So if you were really lucky, your WCs would drain into one of these things and get carried away. Most people had them just drain directly into their basements. Technically, you're supposed to pay a guy to once in a while empty your cesspool in your basement and take it out to the rural areas to be used as fertilizer.
Okay.
London grew really quickly, which meant that the rural areas, the farmland became farther and farther and farther. The cost of hiring someone to take your poop out of your basement and bring it to the farms just went up.
Right.
So then a lot of times people's cesspools just overflowed into one another. So for all those people who love watching historical fiction and era, like movies.
Downton and...
Well, Downton is a little bit
Downton's
after.
Later. Downton's later.
But Victorian era stuff, it was basically just like streets full of poop all the time. All the time. It just overflowed.
Yeah, I've actually heard a rumor. So, you know, how traditionally men are supposed to walk on the outside of women when you're on the street?
Yeah.
This is because in old London, people would empty out their latrines or whatever, and people would just like throw poop out their windows and they would try and miss the sidewalks, but there would be that spray.
Ugh.
So you would let the woman walk inside so that she's not getting sprinkled with
poop.
Yes. I don't know if it's true. That's just something that somebody told me. But yeah, people tossing it out the windows.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was pretty messy So
yeah, it was a disgusting situation. And not to mention, a lot of the drinking water of England came from two sources, either the Thames or wells from groundwater.
Oh, nice.
Right. So you're getting poop water mixing with drinking water, which is, first of all, it's super gross.
Yeah, but there's another reason why that's super bad.
Yeah, cholera.
It's the good one.
It's the gross one. So cholera outbreak in 1853 killed roughly 15,000 people. 600 people died in a month within one neighborhood because one baby had diarrhea and gave everyone cholera.
Yeah, okay. So that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about that sucks.
But at the time, they still didn't know that cholera was spread by eating the germs of someone who had cholera.
Right.
So they didn't know that, but there was an idea that, hey, it smells really bad in London and people are dying of cholera. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're getting all of these kind of overflowing cesspools and overflowing streams and sewers going directly into the Thames, which meant the Thames smelled super bad as well.
Yeah. I didn't smell the Thames when we were there. It's I'll give it that. But it is dirty.
Yeah. And so in the summer of 1858, there was the incident called the Great Stink.
Okay, tell me something about that.
So the Great Stink was a result of all of the waste, all of the people's organic waste going into the Thames, the heat of summer causing all of that organic waste to ferment on the banks of the Thames.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. The river fermented.
That sounds horrible.
It was all types of horrifying. So I've got some fun quotes here of how bad it was. A British newspaper said, "Gentility of speech is at an end. It stinks. And whoso once inhales the stink can never forget it and can count himself lucky if he lives to remember it." So there's tons of these. And at the same time, the House of Parliament had just, I think, either relocated or constructed, or they had just decided that they're going to set up right near the Thames.
Oh, no.
Basically, the rest of the population have been living with this gross smell along with all the other gross stuff for ages. But it wasn't until the members of Parliament had to actually sit along the Thames and try to do their work during the summer of the Great Stink that they finally passed a bill to create a new sewer system that would fix and clean the Thames.
Right. Okay. So that makes sense. You know, it's not that big of a problem until it's my problem.
That's right.
The classic British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were accounts of a few of the members of Parliament trying to tough it out, and they like went out running with handkerchiefs to their noses, and they tried to hang big draperies and tapestries along the walls and the doorways to try to block out the smell, but it just, yeah, none of it worked.
Right.
Okay. To build this new sewer system, which was already talked about for ages, but they kind of dragged their feet about it. Oh, how are we going to do it? Who's going to do it? Et cetera, et cetera. So finally, Joseph Bazalgette, he was the chief engineer, and he was appointed to fix the sewage problem. He was commissioned to build 132 kilometers of interceptor sewers, plus 1,800 kilometers of regular street sewers to get the sewage off the streets, plus pumping stations north and south of the Thames. And he also did a whole bunch of work, including building the embankments along the Thames, building several of the bridges across the Thames. He basically built modern London.
Right.
So this is like the father of modern London.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. I'm going to get into the sewers now.
Right.
How it was built, what was going on. So the problem is there was no standards to build sewers at the time.
Okay.
And now we have the advantage of knowing, you know, water flows downhill, shit flows downhill. It all flows at the same rate. Hundreds of years don't change that. So we can look at how much waste is produced and know from a standard, from a table, what kind of pipe we should use, what size of pipe we should use, and what's the slope that we should put it at.
Sure.
So it's barely engineering for us at this point because you just kind of throw a pipe down.
Okay.
You don't have to do any math, really.
Sure, yeah.
But at the time, they really had no standards. They had no idea. The sewers, like I said, were just ancient streams and rivers. So they didn't necessarily have a regular cross-section or a regular slope. They weren't even really straight.
Okay. So they're starting with a pretty big mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he basically wrote the manual.
Right. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. I'm not entirely sure how he came up with all the values, but because they ran parallel to the Thames, he based the slope of the sewers on the slope of the Thames.
Right. Okay.
Right. So the Thames, as they say, dropped 3 feet per mile, which is at about 0.057%.
3 feet per mile.
Yeah. So his sewers were dropping 2 feet per mile.
Okay.
And I did some math on this to try to see if hydraulically that actually works currently for us.
Right.
So I took the cross section of the pipe that he had designed. It's great because there are so many drawings on record. They kept all of his notes, all of his drawings. It's all available. Magnificent. I can't even find record drawings of things I've done like 5 years ago. So
yeah, that's I think that's a pretty well-known like trying to get anything done in the city. And Toronto is not as old as London, not by a long shot, but like the records that were kept here are just atrocious.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it depends on who you're talking about. The city of Toronto tends to be okay, but like some of the other authorities of Toronto.
I see.
Don't always keep great records.
Yeah.
So 0.038% was what he used. I had to do some math here, which was something I, like I said, didn't have to do before for pipes. So I assume that his pipes were about 20 meters tall, I think a little bit less. And with brick and cement, I kind of figured out what the friction coefficient was. So his flow speed ended up being 0.77 meters per second. And what we use standard for minimum flow speed was 0.6. So he was actually spot on.
Yeah, he did a pretty good job.
For not really knowing it at the time?
Sure.
Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. He also used egg-shaped pipes. So the reason why he used an egg-shaped pipe, you can imagine the egg is actually, I feel stupid saying this, upside down.
Okay, so the skinny side is at the bottom.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like there's no right side up of an egg, but still. Like,
you just say the skinny side is at the bottom.
The skinny side is at the bottom because that meant that when there's not that much flow, that shape gave it a kind of like a restricted area that would force it to flow faster.
Right.
Whereas when there's more flow, it would open up wider so that it would control the speed.
That makes sense.
Right? So yeah. It allows for variability in how much waste or flow you have.
Sure.
Okay. So it was upside down egg shaped, which, you know, I just explained to you why we use that shape.
Yeah.
But before Joseph Bazalgette came around, each of the municipalities and each of the tiny like counties of London would unofficially build its own sewers to no real standards. And sometimes they would build the egg shaped sewer like right side up.
Okay.
So with the fat side down, which completely defeated the purpose of an egg-shaped sewer. Sometimes they built it sideways. Sometimes they would connect like a bigger pipe to a smaller pipe downstream. Like they just had no understanding of how that was working. And they had no coordination between the interfaces of the different towns and counties. So it was a mess that he was inheriting.
Right.
Anyway, what about flow rate and max volume? How do you know how much flow of sewage you actually have to handle?
I would guess that now we have some sort of an average formula.
Right. Based on population density, we can kind of guess.
Yeah.
And of course, on storm data.
Sure. How did he do it?
So he took the densest part of the city. He told them to produce as much sewage as they wanted and as much sewage as they could. And took data from there and then doubled it.
Huh.
Yeah. He doubled it to future-proof it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And okay. Pretty interesting way of tackling it. I guess that's what I would have done. That's what you would have done
it makes
if you
sense.
Had no
yeah.
real
yeah, yeah.
data yeah. at the time. Yeah, that's how he figured out how much waste he would have to handle.
Okay. All right. I get it. I approve of his approach and I admire his spirit.
All right. That was really numbers heavy section.
Yes. That. I mean, I'm awake, but let's get into the good stuff here.
Okay. Material. Back then, like I said, they used a lot of bricks. But in between the bricks, you got to hold it together with some type of glue, yeah?
Yeah, mortar.
Mortar, that's right. So typically at the time, they used Roman cement. I guess really there was no innovation between Roman times and Victoria times. It was just kind of like the Romans figured all the stuff out and then they just used that until 1850s.
Okay.
Hence the Dark Ages.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But he started the use of Portland cement, which is also what we use today, because he knew that it had better strength and durability. He did have to convince the public and all of that that it was a better material. But in the end, he stood by his decision. And because of all this, you know, quality of material, making sure that he had the right numbers and future-proofing, the sewers lasted over 100 years before it needed any sort of significant upgrade.
Okay, that's pretty amazing. Even by modern standards, right?
Absolutely.
You don't build anything for 100 years future-proofing, do you?
No, no.
Ideally.
And especially in a city that grew as fast as London.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Cool.
There were some difficulties in building the sewers. As you can imagine, it's all underground. And at this time, there were already railways and tunnels. And London was already kind of congested underground.
Yeah.
So he built iron aqueducts to pass over the railway. So that's using, you know, the pressure of a smaller aqueduct system. Iron that's flexible and allows it to handle the pressure and kind of like pumping that sewage just quickly over the railway.
Right.
He also had to make sure that the sewage can be pumped back out to the Thames.
Yeah.
To be flushed out. So he had two pumping stations. They were the largest pumps in the world at the time. They pumped sewage up by 6.4 meters.
Okay.
And considering these were the only visible elements of his entire design, like all of the sewer was going to be buried underground and no one, I mean, I think everyone at the time that was living there were super excited because they weren't going to live in a smelly, gross city anymore.
Yeah.
But their kids just wouldn't know.
Right.
Right. So these pumping stations were going to be the only above ground visible legacies.
Okay.
Of what he built.
Okay. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. So they're gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah. The buildings that house these pumping stations, one is built in a Moorish architectural style. Another is built in traditional Victorian style. You can still go and see them today. Absolutely gorgeous pieces of architecture.
Nice.
Yeah, one's at Cross Ness and one's in Abbey Mills, if you are so inclined to check out these still functioning pumping stations.
Cool.
Finally, he had to make sure that once this waste gets into the Thames, it actually doesn't just sit and ferment.
Yeah.
So that is why he also built the embankment.
Okay.
So by building the embankment, he restricted the width of the Thames upstream, which forced the water to flow faster upstream.
Yeah.
Which meant that it would flush out all the waste once it reached downstream.
Clever.
Right. So the embankment included the sewer and the railroad.
Right.
So he had two tunnels basically running under the embankment. He had rebuilt a beautiful road and boulevard above it, a trail, greenery, like a green space. And it's beautiful. Like you can go there now and see it.
Yeah.
And basically that was, you know, served multi-purposes, but one of them was just to flush out the shit downstream.
Right. Okay. Okay. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now the Thames is affected by the ocean tides, right?
Yeah.
So you would have times when that river was moving extremely slowly.
Yes.
Yeah.
The pumping stations actually have huge tanks that hold the waste until it's high tide.
Right.
And it releases a high tide.
Okay.
So one of the things that they didn't design was a water treatment system.
Right.
The waste would just be released into the Thames at high tide completely untreated. Okay. And this was debated for a long time whether it was okay. Now, it wasn't debated for a long time necessarily because of the water. There was a lot of arguments about how they should be reusing that waste and using them on farmlands, that we were just wasting waste.
Yeah.
They said it was very irresponsible not to have built in a recycling system for that waste.
Okay. I can understand that. I mean, I think that that's even a discussion that's happening in a lot of places today.
Yeah. So the discussion here was they thought by flushing out the waste, they were flushing out dollars. For them, it was the idea that you could sell it as fertilizer and make money. Whereas today, we're interested in reusing waste to lower our carbon footprint and our impact sure. on the ecosystem.
Right.
Basically, they did not treat the sewage. And in 1900, the year 1900, there was the Princess Alice disaster.
Oh, no.
The Princess Alice was a ship that kind of went off course. It crashed in the Thames at the same time and at the same place of one of the sewage outfalls.
Oh, no.
So it crashed and 340,000 cubic meters of waste was released. That was the equivalent of 136 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Lovely.
And all of its passengers drowned in the sewage.
Oh. So adding insult to injury.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there were these inquiries into, did the people actually drown or were they just like suffocated by sewage?
Right.
At the time, they still thought like waste could instantly kill you
yeah.
by proximity.
Right.
And so they thought, were the people just like dying of toxicity somehow?
Oh, no.
Waste immediately.
Yeah.
So that kind of really spurred the action of, we can't just toss raw sewage into the Thames.
Sure.
It was still like well into the 1900s before they got a water treatment plant and a sewage treatment plant installed. But there is one now.
Okay. And so what does the sewage treatment plant now do?
It's a very good question. So sewage treatment does a lot to separate. First of all, it separates the matter into solid and liquid.
Okay.
Because what you want to do is be able to release the liquid back into the liquid, right? Sure. So you're going to use multiple sets of filters and flocculation to separate the solid from the liquid. And back then, they actually would add such things as lime, which would react with the solid to kind of turn into these like hard bricks that they could easily extract.
Sure.
And then they would have released the liquid just raw back into the Thames. But now we also do further treatment, such as filtration, flocculation, and UV radiation to kill some of the bacteria. And so there's a lot more into the process to make sure the water is somewhat safe before it goes back into the system.
Cool.
And that's kind of the standard across all sewage treatment plants across the world, in the Western world at least.
Yeah.
But in a major storm, if there was a lot of just storm water that was hitting the sewers, it would overwhelm the sewage treatment plant system. And basically, they would just release the water raw into the overflow of the Thames.
Oh.
The logic being that if there was that much rainwater, the rain was diluting.
Okay. I understand the logic again. It makes sense. It's just raw sewage.
Yeah.
It's a very visceral reaction that I have to that, to those words.
Well, okay. So it's a little different now, right? We tend to separate our organic matter, like our sanitary sewers, being the stuff that comes out of our toilet, is separate from our storm sewers.
Sure.
So in a heavy rainstorm, your storm water is going directly into the lake or the river.
Yeah.
Your poop sewage always goes to the treatment plant.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So that's more or less the history of why this was built and how it was built. And then we can talk about next on how this affected all of London and the legacy it leaves today.
Cool.
The legacy of what Joseph Bazalgette built was felt immediately. The Thames cleared up, the great stink was gone.
Okay.
And with it, cholera was eliminated from the city of London, and typhoid and typhus epidemics were reduced.
Cool. So now cholera, obviously the sewer had a massive impact on cholera, which I know you learned a lot about cholera recently, and as a result, I learned a lot about cholera recently.
So cholera is a bacteria-borne disease that basically sits in your small intestines and it multiplies and it makes you poop yourself to death. Is that a good enough explanation?
Pretty much. And then you get cholera by ingesting something with cholera bacteria on it. So when you have all of these people who's basically just their bowels are just voiding constantly.
Yeah.
And all of that is getting into your water table. And so if you're not disposing of your waste properly, cholera spreads very, very quickly.
Very quickly. And when it gets into your system, it multiplies super quickly and it makes you poop everything in you within a couple of hours. You poop something like a liter an hour.
Oh.
And you only have 4 liters of water in your blood.
Right.
So then it starts pulling water from outside. And by the end of the day, just the day, you're pooping pure bacteria.
Miserable.
It's disgusting. It's called rice water stool because it looks like rice water and it's just bacteria. So all of that goes back into the system, and what it was happening before the interceptor sewers was it was getting into the soil. It was mixing with the water table, like you said, and well water was being contaminated. The Thames water was being contaminated, and it would take one visitor from somewhere else who had cholera, bringing it into the city, and that was it.
Yeah.
The whole town would get it.
It's the end of it.
And it would perpetuate, of course, until it had,
basically wiped out,
burned itself out.
Yeah. And now, all of a sudden, you have someone coming in who's saying, hey, we're going to figure out how to take all of this stuff and just get it away from you immediately. So you're stopping the spread of disease in an absolutely massive way, right? And on top of that, now your politicians are happy because their, office doesn't smell bad, and your citizens are happy because their homes don't smell bad, and you can actually walk along the riverbanks because there's this nice concrete.
Yeah, your river wasn't pickling itself anymore.
Yeah.
So that's, pretty big. And what you can also take away from this is that cholera is not a gone disease. Like, it's not eradicated. We still have cholera in developing worlds because they don't have sewers like this.
Yeah.
For the very reason that they don't have sanitary conditions the way that we've developed it. And so it's like they are still living in Victorian era London.
Sure.
And that's why civil works like this is so important. Thanks for pointing that out. Like, this had major contributions to the sanitary health of the whole public.
Yeah.
And like I said before, just the way that Bazalgette future-proofed the infrastructure, oversizing the pipe capacity, using much more durable material, it survived and it continued servicing London well into the 21st century. Upgrades were made to treat the wastewater, but the system itself remained intact and capable. And so in 2007, London commenced project to expand the capacity, which will be completed in 2020. So basically what he's built is going to hold until 2020, until next year.
That's pretty amazing.
Right? It's quite amazing. Like I said, he also went on to build the embankments along the Thames. So specifically, the embankments housed the sewers, the underground subway system, gas pipes, water pipes, telecommunication wires. It held everything. It really kind of brought in the new age for London.
Sure.
He was eventually knighted.
Good.
And remembered as the engineer that built modern London. Like I said, all his notes and reports are all available. A lot of it has been scanned, so it's even available online. There's a lot of glowing reports from other engineers talking about how great his contributions were, just praising his ideas and fully supporting his designs. It's amazing. I don't know that many engineers today that support each other that well.
Yeah.
But it was really nice to see. Of course, he had his opposition as well.
Sure.
And we might talk about that another time because that's a whole lot of politics.
Ooh, my favorite.
Yeah.
Nothing I love more than political bickering.
You know what engineers love? Politicians.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we love politicians that aren't engineers telling us what to do.
Yeah.
We just love them.
See, but then, okay, also to be fair, who funds the majority of your projects? Those same politicians.
I know.
So they're kind... Anyways, I hate politics and I hate politicians in general. But I will say that, you know, you guys have got to have that symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. I mean, it's understood that engineers would put a lot of money into infrastructure if we were given the rights. And so we leave it to the politicians to handle the money. And they should leave the technical stuff to the subject matter experts. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So it's great that these sewers have survived to today, but they are at risk
of
the Fatbergs.
Okay.
Have you heard of the Fatbergs?
So you had hinted at something. The Fatbergs sounds truly terrible.
The story gets more and more gross. So Fatbergs are found all over the world. They're buildups of grease and waste that have calcified into basically giant bergs, like icebergs.
Right.
But Fatbergs, and they're clogging up our sewers.
Sure.
This happens when basically your sewers are not necessarily smooth on the inside, right? Especially when they're made of bricks.
Yeah.
They can cause turbulence in the flow. And turbulence is a great way of separating the solid from the fluid. It's one of the ways that we actually use in treatment is we kind of stir up all of the stuff and it pushes all the solids to one side. So turbulence in the pipes can consolidate all of the solids together and make them clump. And then you've got things like grease that people will flush down the sink. And that will kind of bind it all together like glue.
Yeah.
And then it'll calcify, which makes it harden.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just turns into a snowball effect because now you've got this thing that other ways can stick onto and grab hold of. And it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and it clogs up. These things have been absolutely massive. There are pictures online you can see of the London Fatberg. It's massive. It's like 10, 15 meters in diameter. It's disgusting. Solid grease and things like wet wipes, feminine products, condoms, cot swabs. And
so basically all of these things are things that we're told not to flush down the toilet.
Right.
And we all flush them down the toilet anyways, because when you hit flush, they go. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gross.
Sure.
And this stuff is really just damaging our sewers and making things also back up.
Yeah.
So don't flush stuff down the toilet and don't just like throw your grease in through the sink. There are ways to get to dispose of that stuff because otherwise you're just going to build Fatbergs.
Sure. And so a lot of times when I pour something down the sink that I maybe shouldn't, I just make up for it by running hot water, right? And then you think, oh, I got all this extra water. It's going to dilute everything. But what you're saying is that that doesn't work.
No.
It's not enough.
No. You really have to either dispose of the grease by neutralizing it somehow. Just don't pour it down the sink.
Take it to the dump, you idiot.
I don't know. Refry beans with it. Like, do something else with your grease, but don't throw it down the sink.
Yeah.
And it's more than just the grease. If it was just the grease, we would be fine.
Yeah.
It's the solids.
Right.
Right? Don't flush condoms down the toilet.
No.
Don't flush feminine products down the toilet. Don't flush food down the toilet. If you have a carburetor, like, make sure it works.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're really difficult to resolve. You have to reline the sewers and you have to break down the solids sometimes mechanically, sometimes chemically.
Yikes.
There's been some exploration into maybe using fatbergs as biofuels.
Okay.
Right?
That's good. Yeah.
It seems like anything organic, we just try to like throw it into an engine and see if it'll work.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I appreciate the spirit.
Sure. I mean, if you give it enough time, really those fatbergs are kind of prime candidates to become fossil fuels, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So all that we got to do
is... It's just not fossil yet.
No, exactly.
It's just fuel.
Yeah. So we've got, I mean, we have a couple years to go before that all fossilizes. But if it's already calcifying, I mean...
Yeah. You're going to need a lot of pressure.
So
anyway.
Really, you're welcome, future generations.
No, don't build fatbergs.
Okay.
Don't. It's just going to mean we're going to have to replace all of these major sewers. And it sucks, right?
It's, yeah. Okay.
Let's keep this awesome, wonderful Victorian legacy as long as we can.
Sure.
So I will say that the interceptor sewers did kind of initiate a lot of the construction of interceptor sewers elsewhere around the world. I think at one point there was a project in a town in Germany where they tried to copy the design. And at this time, they still weren't totally convinced that water was what propagated cholera.
Sure.
So cholera did have an outbreak in this German town where they built the interceptor sewers and they said, oh, look, it's not water after all. But in the end, they found out that the sewer was actually had burst.
Oh, nice.
So it was a direct causation then. And they were like, oh, okay. So it is linked. So yeah, no, the sewers definitely made big waves. London's interceptor sewers being the first ones to really make a significant impact in a major urban area. So right. I think it's a major achievement. I think people don't think about what's under their feet, right? I mean, certainly we live probably on one of the smelliest streets in Toronto, right?
I mean, yeah, it gets pretty bad. But I remember when you lived in Edmonton and Edmonton has what, half of the cosmopolitan population and like nothing for the metro population, right? And Edmonton smelled horrible.
Yeah.
It was bad. Every street, everywhere you turned, it was just that like raw sewage. Yeah. Not good.
So there's a lot to be said about a well-running sewage system is one that you don't think about.
No.
And maybe you should. Maybe you should be grateful for the fact that it doesn't bother you.
That's right. And even when you're walking down the street and you just get hit with that little punch in your nose, you know, that's still better than the alternative because that is like an isolated stream of air compared to what
drowning
really could be.
In 136 Olympic-sized swimming pools of it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, right now, we live near a lake. When we were growing up, we lived in cities that typically had like big rivers going through the middle, right? I'm not saying exactly like London, but if those cities didn't have proper sewers, we definitely would have had smelly rivers. And Toronto, I mean, Lake Ontario does kind of smell.
Only sometimes.
Only sometimes, but it does.
It's not because it's fermenting, which
it's just, I know.
I didn't know that a large body of water could ferment.
Yeah.
So thank you, Joseph Bazalgette, for building this thing. That's it. That's the London Interceptor Sewers. Did it live up to my hype?
So the one thing I will say is that I feel like the Interceptor Sewers are still like an engineer's discussion.
Yeah, right? This is an engineering podcast, John.
No, I know. It's just like, you know, there's a lot to be grateful for as a layperson.
Yes, for sure. And that's what this podcast is all about.
Yeah.
Just kind of look around and see the things that people built.
That's right.
To give us easy, comfortable lives.
Yeah. All of these things that you take for granted, somebody had to figure out how to make that work.
That's right. So that's it for this episode. Please subscribe and rate if you enjoyed this episode. We very much appreciate it. You can find us at Measured in Metric on Instagram and on Facebook, at Measured in Net on Twitter. Leave us some comments what you would like to hear about next. We'd love to hear from you.
That's right.
And as always, remember to measure in metric.